Now on that same day, two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem, and talking with each other about all these things that had happened. While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And he said to them, "What are you discussing with each other while you walk along?" They stood still, looking sad. Then one of them, whose name was Cleopas, answered him, "Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have taken place there in these days?" He asked them, "What things?" They replied, "The things about Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, and how our chief priests and leaders handed him over to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. Yes, and besides all this, it is now the third day since these things took place. Moreover, some women of our group astounded us. They were at the tomb early this morning, and when they did not find his body there, they came back and told us that they had indeed seen a vision of angels, who said that he was alive. Some of them, who were with us, went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but they did not see him." Then he said to them, "Oh, how foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have declared. Was it not necessary that the Messiah should suffer these things and then enter into his glory?" Then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them the things about himself in all the scriptures. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road, and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread.
Thank you, Eve. Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road? Were not our hearts burning within us? Or to translate it into Methodist language, were not our hearts strangely warmed? I yearn for that feeling. To have a chest filled to overflowing with a heart that is warm and soft and pliable, able to connect to anyone and everyone, able to grow 3 sizes that day without shattering into a million pieces. How about you? David Brooks is a conservative pundit who writes for the New York Times. He is smart and well-read and eloquent, and while I do not often agree with him, I almost always learn something from him. Last Sunday, he wrote a deeply thoughtful piece called The Moral Bucket List, and I encourage you to go online and take a look at it. He began the article like this: About once a month, I run across a person who radiates an inner light. These people can be in any walk of life. They seem deeply good. They listen well. They make you feel funny and valued. You often catch them looking after other people. And as they do, their laugh is musical and their manner is infused with gratitude. They are not thinking about what wonderful work they are doing. They are not thinking about themselves at all. When I meet such a person, he writes, it brightens my whole day. But I confess, I often have a sadder thought. I have not achieved that. I have not achieved that generosity of spirit or that depth of character. David Brooks is intelligent enough to recognize that lack in himself through astute observation. People like me, on the other hand, usually require a divine 2x4 upside the head, a 2x4 of humility that whacks me hard. I got hit with it the first time when I was pretty new to ministry, way back in the day, 1989, 1990 or so, in the panicky days when the AIDS pandemic was just starting to affect even rural Vermont. I volunteered as a community educator for a Northeast Kingdom agency that provided care for AIDS patients and education for the community. And the best part is I got to be a chaplain for their annual spiritual retreat. I loved it. It was wonderful. The men I worked with were mostly young gay men who had returned home to the Northeast Kingdom when they had contracted the disease off in Boston or San Francisco. They were smart. They were self-reflective. They could talk art and theology and books and, not to stereotype, but Broadway shows. They were open to prayer. They were open to meditation and spiritual practices. And they were incredibly grateful for the grace of God that they met in the stories of Jesus. Lives were changed. I felt good about what I was doing. I felt good about myself. Good job, Mitch! Pat self on back. You are sensitive, compassionate, and a damn cool young pastor, sharing light and love wherever you go. Way to go. Give yourself a pat on the back. Over the next couple years, the demographics of Northeast Kingdom AIDS patients changed. IV drug use among the rural poor was skyrocketing. And our new patients were more likely to have caught the virus from sharing needles in an island pond mobile home than from unprotected sex in a San Francisco apartment building. And these guys started showing up at the spiritual retreats. Can you close that door? Thanks. They started showing up at our spiritual retreats on Harleys. And they were tattooed and seething with an unfocused, macho, bitter anger. They were not literary or clever or fabulous. They called the gay patients fags. And they called each other even worse. And they talked about bikes and trucks rather than art and poetry and musicals. They were not interested in worship or prayer or meditation. They needed something else, but I didn't know what to offer them or how to offer it. And I realized to my horror that I really didn't want to offer it to them. I looked hard at myself and I realized that I didn't like these mean, loud, junky bikers. They scared me. I felt like they killed my retreat, and I was resentful. That was the 2x4 of humility. I realized what a hypocrite I was. I was not sensitive or compassionate or cool or loving. I simply liked working with people I liked. I like to work with people who, apart from their sexual orientation and HIV status, pretty much look like me. And when folks who didn't look like me showed up with gaping, ragged spiritual wounds, I turned away. I shut down. My heart was ugly and small and brittle. I was not the person that David Brooks says radiated an inner life. Now, externally, I got off easy. AIDS funding dried up the next year, and the retreats were canceled, and I could walk away clean. I was off the hook. But internally, I was deeply disappointed in myself, because I knew that really I had walked away from them before the funding dried out. I had walked away from people who needed something, and I was too scared to offer. Maybe you've been in a similar place. Maybe you let down a friend who was counting on you. Maybe you were satisfied with mediocrity when you could have reached for the stars. Maybe you had enough pain around you or within you that you just needed to escape somewhere dark, alone, to lick your wounds. That place, that spiritual place, is where our Emmaus is. Emmaus is the place of our self-disappointment, of our cynicism, of our despair, and our hopelessness, and our disillusionment. Emmaus is nowhere, and Emmaus is everywhere. Everywhere there is sin and brokenness, there is Emmaus. And this is crucial. If you're going to write down one thing today, this is it. Our spiritual maturity requires an Emmaus. Because Emmaus is where we encounter resurrection. In our reading from Luke's gospel, Jesus, alive and raised, walks with Cleopas and the other unnamed disciple, but it was likely his wife Mary. In the midst of their despair, Jesus meets them. In the depths of their hopelessness and fear at the loss of their master and their teacher and their friend, He comes to them and he walks with them. In the black hole of their pain, he teaches them. But they don't recognize him. When they get to Emmaus, where they had hoped to find escape and safety, they act the good hosts. And they ask the stranger to stay with them for as the King James Version so eloquently puts it, the day is far spent. They ask him to stay. Jesus does not impose upon them. But once in the room, Jesus plays the host. He switches the roles, and he takes bread and blesses it and breaks it and gives it to them. And Luke says, their eyes were opened. They recognized him. Not in the eloquent teaching, not in preaching, not in any discourse of speech or ideas or philosophy or theology. They recognized the resurrected Jesus by experiencing him in bread broken. In the familiar prayers and movements of 1,000 shared meals together. It was broken bread that broke into their suffering. And their eyes were opened, and their hearts were melted. Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us? We live in an age of microwave meals and quick fixes and ads that promise thin thighs with 3 easy payments and churches that advertise salvation in 3 easy steps. In that kind of world, the lesson from Emmaus is not a popular one. It's not an easy one. But here it is. Spiritual maturity requires getting your heart broken. There's no easy journey, and there's no painless journey to spiritual maturity. It requires getting your hearts broken. Experiencing resurrection means seeing and experiencing suffering first. It means knowing death first. There are not any shortcuts. Growing spiritually is not escaping from the suffering of the world, is not chanting Om on top of a mountain. It is entering into the dirt and the struggle and the scrum of life and taking it in. It means that you get your heart torn and stretched and strengthened. And it's something I did not do when I was faced with needy people who scared me in the Northeast Kingdom. And I regret that powerfully. But thankfully, life has presented many newer opportunities to have my heart stretched and broken since then. Parker Palmer is a beautiful Quaker poet, philosopher. He writes this: my heart is stretched every time I am able to take in life's little deaths without an anesthetic. A friendship gone sour, a mean-spirited critique of my work, failure at a task that was important to me. I can also exercise my heart by taking in life's little joys, a small kindness from a stranger, the sound of a distant train reviving childhood memories, the infectious giggle of a 2-year-old as I hide and then leap out from behind cupped hands. Taking it all in, good and bad alike, is a form of exercise that slowly transforms my clenched fist of a heart into an open hand. In the video I showed the kids, it was the Grinch's taking it all in. The pain he caused and the joy he witnessed that allowed his heart to grow 3 sizes that day. As followers of Jesus, we are called, we are commissioned, we are equipped, we are sent out into a hurting world where we can put ourselves in places of suffering until our hearts will be stretched and grown. Our Easter series question is this: how then shall we live? And the answer of Emmaus is, we live in the quiet joy that comes from entering another's pain. I know that sounds ridiculous. We live in the subtle recognition that it is Jesus we meet in the unexpected places. In our Emmaus. In another person's Emmaus. In the places where compassion meets pain. Where hunger meets broken bread. Where loneliness meets companions on the road. I am privileged in this place to see hearts stretch in this community of faith over and over. Places where Emmaus is transformed into resurrection, where the death of a dear one leads to compassionate caring for others, or to a passion for teaching, or towards a yearning to build community. Where tragedy, which could lead to self-protection, but instead it leads to greater openness to love and to share and to risk offering oneself to another. That is living as resurrection people. That is the quiet joy of Easter among us. In the David Brooks article I referenced at the beginning of the sermon, it's a very secular article. He's not talking about the Emmaus Road experience specifically, but he still sees, he doesn't use the word spiritual maturity, but he sees that maturity as a road trip nonetheless, even if it's not the road to Emmaus. He writes, "The people on this road see the moments of suffering as pieces of a larger narrative. They are not really living for happiness, as it is conventionally defined. They see life as a moral drama and feel fulfilled only when they are enmeshed in a struggle on behalf of another ideal. This is a philosophy for travelers. The traveler scuffs through life a little off balance. But she faces her imperfect nature with unvarnished honesty, with the opposite of squeamishness, recognizing her limitations, she finds herself to be the interior or internal foe to overcome and transcend. The traveler has an outstretched arm, ready to receive and offer assistance. Her friends are there for deep conversation and comfort and advice. And the travelers experience moments of joy. There's joy in freely chosen obedience to organizations and ideas and people. There's joy in mutual journeying. There's an aesthetic joy we feel when we see morally good action, when we run across someone who is quiet and humble and good, when we see that however old we are, there is still lots to do ahead. The traveler doesn't build her life by being better than others, but by being better than she used to be. Unexpectedly, there are transcendent moments of deep tranquility. For most of their lives, their inner and outer ambitions are strong and in balance. But eventually, at moments of rare joy, the traveler looks out at a picnic or a dinner or a valley and is overwhelmed by a feeling of limitless gratitude and an acceptance of the fact that life has treated her much better than she deserves. Those are the people we want to be. That's David Brooks. I invite you to travel on the road to Emmaus. I invite you to put yourself in the difficult places where your heart risks being stretched and broken or strangely warmed. I invite you to meet the risen Christ in the places you least expect, where you are least comfortable, and where you will find resurrection.